Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today's guest, David Wyss. He's a founder and director of Nutrition in Recovery. His master's degree is in the field of, it's in the field of nutrition, right? But you were also a registered dietitian nutritionist. That's
right.
Training that you completed. And his focus is on supporting recovery through proper nutrition. In part one, we've outlined the proposition. Let's talk about specific protocols that you've developed for various types of addiction. I know that it's not hard and fast. This isn't rocket science. It's not like vitamin B1 is a cure for a cocaine addiction, and you might use vitamin B3 for, opioid addiction. It's not that cut and dried. But are there distinct patterns of nutritional requirement for different types of addiction?
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Hoffman, for having me on the show and for talking about something that's very important and near and dear to me. There's definitely going to be some differences between different substances of abuse, as well as a lot of overlapping recommendations for recovery from all substance use disorders. I think the American public or the general public is always looking for, like you said, that kind of magic bullet. Like, what's the one supplement that's going to work for cocaine, mm-hmm. and the one vitamin that works for alcohol? And, you know, while the evidence does suggest that there are some things, I think it's better that we put more attention into the bigger picture. In other words, you know, if it was just about, you know, repleting vitamins and minerals that were deficient, I think it would be easy. But the main challenge is in actually addressing the eating behavior and helping people develop life skills to cook and shop, etc. But to answer your question about specific substances, we do know that, for example, alcohol can present with, you know, B vitamin deficiencies, thiamine particularly. So it does make sense to use a full spectrum multivitamin or mineral broken into at least two separate daily doses.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps magnesium might play a role there.
Yes. And we have evidence of, you know, vitamin D deficiencies. So using possibly that, as well as direct sunlight, you know, for 20 minutes twice a week. Omega-3, DHA-rich, 3 grams a day, can be helpful. I do also recommend reducing exposure to omega-6 inflammatory fatty acids, and then a probiotic supplement, refrigerated, if possible. And then, you know, being mindful of a high-protein diet, but not going too high for alcohol, because of, you know, compromised liver and or kidney function. We do need more information regarding alcohol, about how supplements are best absorbed, if a liquid would be better than a pill, if supplemental zinc would be effective in improving the gut permeability, if there's a supplement called SAM, which has shown some interest.
Right?
Yes,
yep.
Correct. We need to know which particular strains are optimal, how nutrition interventions should differ based on the presence or progression of liver disease. And then we definitely need to know more about the link between alcoholism and the hormonal response, insulin, leptin, and ghrelin. So for other substances, you know, like, for example, cocaine and methamphetamine, you know, we can make some pretty clear recommendations about, again, a protein-rich diet. I do think that, you know, certain protein powders can help.
And why the protein-rich diet? Because, A, they haven't been getting enough protein during the addiction phase, or because it's going to provide building blocks for the neurotransmitters?
I think they're both true. We know that neurotransmitter depletion does require amino acids as building blocks, although in the last few years, you know, it's been discovered that more than half of dopamine, as well as the majority of serotonin, is produced in the gut, We still need those amino acid building blocks. I think there's a lot of interest in high dose amino acid therapy for addiction. Mm-hmm. I haven't gotten.
There's the Matthews Larson, I think. What is her correct. First name? Eleanor Matthews Larson was a big addiction person in another mecca for recovery, which is Minneapolis.
That's right.
This was in the 70s and 80s, and I think she published a book on amino acid support and nutritional support for addicts.
Yes.
Matthews Larson. That's right.
There it is. There it is. Yeah, that's been interesting, and there's been a lot of people that have, I think, developed, you know, some of those protocols further in a society that kind of has that kind of end goal in mind. I found that it's, you know, more practical to use just an overall higher protein diet, assuming that one has access and is able to do that. I also like to be careful because, you know, the drugs of abuse can cause a lot of, you know, physiological strain on organs such as, you know, the liver. And I think getting involved with really high dose things, it makes me a little nervous, mm-hmm. to be honest.
Mm-hmm. So you're more into a practical approach, which involves food being, you know, of utmost importance, the timing of meals, attitude towards eating, the ability to source food properly and prepare food, because I think food preparation is actually one of the keys to success here, because, you know, it's a self-nurturing kind of thing when you prepare food that is healthy. And, you know, it's that daily practice kind of really solidifies a commitment towards health.
Yeah, that's the angle that I take. I'm actually, you know, all for the supplements, but I think the eating behavior is the hard part, and so I've kind of like tried to rise to that challenge, and actually get people to move in the general direction of eating whole foods, and then, you know, at some point, you know, transitioning off the supplements.
Mm-hmm. Can you share with us some of your success stories? I mean, what's it like in the field when you utilize this approach?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the main thing that I try to do in running groups in these settings is get people to see the necessity. And part of that sometimes involves, you know, getting people to see how they may have been deceived about nutrition, or marketed to, or perhaps even been targeted, you know, by, you know, food industry efforts. And I get people excited about looking at it differently. And then once the need is established, I like to challenge people to make very small, gradual changes. And, you know, sometimes people are they're there and they're ready and they're willing and they can follow directions. Other times I've had cases where, you know, for example, someone who has grown up in eating highly processed westernized foods and like actually doesn't like any fruits or vegetables, mm-hmm. or whole grains or beans or nuts or seeds, like has developed a strong aversion to them, you know, given that they've only mm-hmm. exposed their brain to highly palatable food. And actually have a very difficult time with anything that's, you know, fibrous. So I've had a lot of cases where I'll have someone start with something like, let's just add one baby carrot to your meal.
Wow.
And start with, you know, one strawberry with your breakfast.
Wow.
And then we go from there to the next day, we're up to two. And then eventually we have, you know, two or three bites of a fruit or vegetable at every meal or snack. And then, you know, doing that kind of approach can ease someone into making changes. And then they start to say things like, oh, my bowel movements have changed. I feel a little bit sharper. And then, you know, I've had a couple cases of people really just buy in mm-hmm. and flip and go all the way from not even being able to consume the food to actually seeking it out, craving mm-hmm. it. And, getting really excited. I had one challenging case of someone who had a lot of food aversions, ate pretty much convenience food for the most part. And, you know, I had a feeling like he needed a more drastic intervention. And, you know, I kind of pulled him aside. I was like, hey, listen, you know, like, I don't do this often, but I'm going to take a risk with you. Like, your situation is severe, and I need you to eat a can of sardines with the skin and bones every day for the next week.
Wow.
And I need you to eat a can of beans.
Yeah.
And I had him do a can of sardines, a can of beans, and a fresh vegetable juice every day for the next week. And he came back and he was a changed man. And he was so grateful that I had actually taken a risk and given him some clear cut directions that he was able to follow.
Yeah.
And his skin changed, his eyes changed, and he became like the nutrition and recovery cheerleader.
Wow.
And started a revolution with some of the other men. That's the other thing I'd like to add is that, you know, I bring in a psychology of men perspective into, you know, a lot of these treatment settings. There's a lot of ideas about, you know, how men are supposed to eat versus women.
Yeah.
And I like to challenge a lot of those things. And I have found that that approach is very effective in getting men who otherwise think that nutrition doesn't really apply to them to buy in and get involved in, you know, health in a new way.
One of your mottos that you share is never hungry, never full. What's that about?
Yeah, thanks. That's such a powerful little summary of how to approach eating in recovery. Like I said before, when people postpone or evade eating, allow themselves to get starving, there's a really good chance that they'll go from that extreme all the way to the other side. And so I recommend people eating breakfast within 30 minutes of waking up.
It's sort of like preemptive eating. In other words, you know, whether you're hungry or not, you know, and this is the way that normal people who have to go to work, you know, eat. Like, sometimes I'm not that hungry, but I know that I've got, you know, 8 hours of patience ahead of me. I'm going to have a solid breakfast before I head into the office.
That's right. I tell people the biggest risk factor for overeating is undereating.
Hmm.
So that's the model. Eat preemptively, like you said. And I try to get people to eat every 2.5 to 4.5 hours, which comes out to, you know, 4 to 6 times a day. Ideally, maybe 5 times a day they're eating. I like to bridge the gap between meals and snacks. So instead of having really large meals and small snacks, I encourage people to have large snacks and smaller meals. That way, if they're eating 5 times throughout the course of the day, the caloric load from the meals and snacks would actually be somewhat evenly distributed throughout the course of the day.
Which stabilizes blood sugar, which I think is a main reason for mood changes.
That's right. I think that's a big part. And based on what we know about how the hormones communicate with the reward centers, I'm curious to know if that consistent type of eating with a never hungry, never full approach can actually, you know, be helpful to some of the reward mechanisms in the brain in terms of the physiological healing.
And you make a distinction between wanting versus liking. Again, what's that about?
Yeah, that's such an important addiction concept that has emerged in the scientific literature. You know, wanting is the actual it's just the craving. It's the incentive. It's the dopamine-driven aspect of craving something, wanting something. You see a commercial and it activates a part of the brain that reminds you of when that was consumed in the past. And it's able to set up a neurochemical cascade of anticipatory behavior, which set up the motivation to consume. Whereas the liking is the actual euphoria or the pleasure that's received from the substance or the behavior. So that involves the dopamine system as well as the opioid system and some other systems, including GABA. It's a little bit more neurochemically complex. But the idea behind this discernment is that often with addiction, the wanting will increase, whereas the liking will stay stable or will decrease over time. So there's a strong desire for example, you know, going through a drive-through. The commercials are there. There's a picture of the burger. The wanting is really high, but when it's actually experienced the pleasure, it doesn't match up to the wanting. And so this is true for drugs of abuse, and then becomes very true for food in early recovery. A lot of the food that people crave are highly wanted, definitely enjoyed. It doesn't mean that they're not liked, but the liking doesn't actually match the wanting.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like when I was a smoker, that first cigarette of the day, it seemed to taste so good, the first couple of puffs, but at the end of it, it wasn't worth it.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
So these ideas, I think, really deserve a place in our addiction treatment system, and this is going to be a huge priority in America. And now that it's been declared a national emergency, there's going to be a lot of research dollars. There's going to be a lot of treatment dollars put into it. It's a crisis, and we have to respond to it. Do you see some of these ideas making it to mainstream, or are you still a little bit of a voice in the wilderness in the addiction community?
Well, once something gets the level of attention that you've described, and there is funding, I think things change. One of the reasons why it's been so underutilized and underaddressed is because the current insurance-based healthcare model doesn't actually recognize nutrition as a treatment modality. So it ends up just kind of being a cost center for treatment centers. It ends up just being an additional expense. Whereas if we could get more evidence and get to a place where it was, very clear that this could reduce recidivism, reduce healthcare burden, that this was an effective, adjunct therapy to traditional addiction treatment, I do see it, increasing in its involvement. I actually am in the process of writing a short little statement for the CDC for nutrition for the opioid addiction. And I don't know if I shared this with you, but I'm doing a PhD in public health at UCLA.
Oh, great.
So I'm going to be doing this. This is what I'm doing. I'm doing this. This is my mission, nutrition for addiction recovery and for the opioid crisis, and to make this information about dietary supplements, healthful eating, reducing disordered eating, part of the mainstream for addiction treatment. I'm sure it'll take many, many years, but I'm committed, and it's good to know there's people like you out there that are like-minded.
Well, David, before we share with our audience some resources, some free resources that are available through your website and so on, let's take a break to let one of our sponsors share this message.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Okay, thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. And so, David, what's today's Intelligent Medicine take-home message? What can we do, those of us who may be suffering from an addiction problem? Perhaps we've received some addiction treatment. It's been partially successful. How can we access the type of care that your centers offer? And what can we find on your website? There are lots of resources there.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of take-home messages. And I think that one of the overarching themes is that we need to prioritize nutrition in early recovery, not necessarily postponing it until later, making a thing that we consider at 6 months sober or 2 years sober. This needs to be a topic that starts early on in the first couple weeks of recovery. I think the important thing to consider first and foremost is addressing the gut dysbiosis, replacing the sweetened beverages with water, moving towards a more high fiber diet, beans, nuts, seeds, whole grains over refined grains. We certainly want to use whatever supplements we can to address any nutritional imbalances. Probiotics are helpful. Fermented foods are helpful. And then we want to think about an anti-inflammatory approach to eating, you know, with, you know, food that's high in vitamins A, C, E, selenium, iron. We talked about omega-3. And then focusing on not just what to eat, but when to eat, getting on a kind of feeding pattern to keep blood sugar stable. And then finally starting to think about how to eat, bringing in mindful eating, slowing down. I think people in early recovery have a tendency to consume food very rapidly, slowing it all down, and then putting it all in the context of the entire dimension of wellness, thinking about reducing caffeine, nicotine that can be used in excess, artificial sweeteners, and putting it in the context of let's change the way we eat to change the way we feel, change the way we live, and make recovery a really comfortable place so that we can live here.
And what are some of the resources on your website? It's nutritioninrecovery.com. There's an excellent video which kind of introduces a general audience to your approach. And there's lots of articles. And you also, do you have a newsletter as well?
Yes. So we have a monthly newsletter where we send out a 5-minute video. And if you go to nutritionin, that's inrecovery.com, you should find a link to sign up for the newsletter. If you click on publications, there's a lot of previous presentations that I've given, webinars that have been recorded, and there's even some links to some of my peer-reviewed journal articles that are open access and are shared. So if you scroll down the publications, you'll find lots of goodies. The newsletter has been great. We've talked about nutrition for addiction. Last month, we talked about food addiction. And the one that's about to come out will be about the microbiome as it relates to mental health.
Well, excellent. David, I want to commend you for your great focus on this vital issue. And it's a timely focus because this approach, I think, is really going to grow in support of our overall war against addictive problems in this country. It's very appropriate. Thanks so much for joining us. Once again, David Wyss, you want to give out the information about your office as well? Because, you know, we have listeners all across the country and around the world. I'm based in New York. So what if, for example, let's say this awakens the interest of someone in Connecticut. How can they communicate with your center? Can they work remotely with you? Does it require a visit?
Yeah, no. Headquarters is here in West LA in the Barrington Gardens. And we are mobile. I have a team of dietitians. So we do bring our services to lots of different facilities in the Southern California area. We have done consulting work abroad. We have done it internationally, traveled to the facility to up the food service environment and bring some of the curriculum, you know, to the treatment team. And I'm also able to do some consulting, you know, distance wise with Skype or phone. And I love doing that kind of work because I really believe in getting this message out there. And, you know, I go the extra mile to help people prepare to bring this information to people in recovery.
Well, good stuff. Thank you so much for joining us. David Wyss, Nutrition in Recovery. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.